is Phil Vischer. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm here with Sky Jatani and Christian Taylor. Christian, again, is giving up her mic to a very special guest that will be with us the whole time. Our special guest today is Mr. Oz Guinness, Dr. Oz Guinness. Should we call you doctor? Or?
No, just call me Oz.
Okay, that works. So we have to start with the theme song, of course, and it goes something like this. Hey, it's a podcast. What do you know? Hey, it's a podcast. So there's no video. Hey, it's a podcast. So lend an ear. The Phil Vischer podcast starts right here. We'll talk to Sky and Christian too, and maybe Oz Guinness here just for you. Hey, it's a podcast. So lend an ear. The Phil Vischer podcast starts right here. The Phil Vischer podcast starts right here. Okay. That's our theme song. I'm here with Sky and with a very special guest. If you don't know who Oz Guinness is, first of all, shame on you. Where have you been? Or you're young and you don't know yet, because, okay, so now you do. We hope we have a younger audience.
That's the hope.
Than, say, Pat Robertson, say. We hope. Anyway, Oz Guinness, he was born in China. He's the great-great-great-great-grandson of Arthur Guinness. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Do you get free beer for life?
No, sadly not.
Oh, that's too bad. Now, American Christians, you know, we especially, I was raised in Iowa, small town Iowa, very, very small, very conservative evangelical free church. So even the mention, we couldn't even say the word beer.
But Americans are loosening up.
We are. We're loosening up. Yeah. My grandparents did not loosen up. They held to their standards to the very end. He was a witness to the climax of the Chinese Revolution in 1949 and returned to England in 1951, where he went to school and college, received a BD from University of London and a divinity? No. Doctor of Philosophy from Oxford. In 1842. 1981. What'd you do between the 66
and
the
81? I was at
LaBrie. Oh, okay, that's when you were at LaBrie. Right.
A lot of fun.
Why don't they mention that on Wikipedia? They don't like LaBrie.
Well, as you probably know, I mean, Schaeffer, there's a polarized opinion. He's demonized in the academic world and lionized in the fundamentalist world. And I never know quite which side I'm going to be caught on.
Let's leave it out, huh?
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. The next sentence. In the 60s, he was a leader at LaBrie. Okay. I needed to read ahead. Came to the United States in 1984, where he was a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institute, the lead drafter of the Williamsburg Charter. This sounds like a lot of very heavy stuff. Not very funny, but important, valuable.
Yes.
Yes. He founded the Trinity Forum in 1991 and served as senior fellow until 2004. Has written or edited more than 25 books and currently lives in McLean, Virginia. That's a pretty serious place to live, too.
A lot of interesting people.
I imagine so. I imagine
Kennedy
so.
Kennedy family to Newt Gingrich.
Must be a great block party.
Yeah. I was just going to say, do you all get together for barbecues?
No, you see them in the restaurants every so often.
Okay, well, thanks for coming. Oz is in town for a conference at Wheaton College, and so we're kind of a parasitic appendage to Wheaton College, and we glom on to whoever swings through town.
Well, he was very kind to agree to this, and Oz and I don't get to see each other all that often, so when I found out you were coming to Wheaton, we got to get together, and then it became, well, why not do a podcast?
Yeah, and then what's next?
Yeah.
Why not do a talk show? And then why not, let's make a feature film. Let's a reality show.
Oh, I feel the call to Wheaton already.
There you go.
We would.
Maybe not.
We would keep you busy. Okay, my first question, you know, and this is kind of a mix of the lighter and the deeper, the wider and the all that. Do people automatically assume you're intelligent because you've got a great proper British accent?
You know, the Scottish accent goes with Presbyterianism.
Okay.
And the English accent tends to go with Anglicanism.
Yes.
And with intelligence. Yeah. I'm not quite sure why.
Right, because if you, I mean, if you showed up, you know, with a real thick Cockney,
I know.
No one would listen to you. I want to talk to you about my new book. It wouldn't.
Well, in England, that would be even more superior.
Yeah.
You know, there's kind of reverse snobbery today.
Oh,
so
okay.
You listen to Michael Caine revert to his normal accent. It's
yes,
terrific.
And we're like, huh. Oh, we applaud.
Yeah, yay, absolutely.
He's a common man.
That's
but
beautiful.
Is it partly just the I think we have some latent guilt about 1776, so that when we hear an English accent, we just naturally want to submit.
Well, I think it's largely movies. You know, whenever you cast someone with a very proper, you know, upper class British accent, they're either oppressing someone or educating them.
Good point. Mm.
Don't you think?
So we've been conditioned to
yes,
just associate.
Yes, we're conditioned
to
we hear. So are you, because you've been here a long time.
27 years.
Yes. Do you work to try to maintain your proper...
You try My to accent's s- not actually very English. I mean, the English think I'm American. Americans think I'm English. I call it mid-Atlantic.
Okay. Okay. Well, is it moving? Is it moving over the years?
No.
Or has it always been mid-Atlantic? The
20 or so friends I came with who were English, I'm the only one still English. The others have all become American.
Okay, so, but you need to sustain that because it gives you gravitas.
Well, no. I sustain it because I happen to like it.
Okay.
Which do you want me to choose?
Okay, that works.
Louisiana accent?
That works. Well, I mean, if you lived in, say, Charleston, South Carolina, you think it would be harder to sustain?
No.
That He's is impervious.
So different that I would be aware of it every moment.
Okay. All right. Well, we won't try to corrupt your fine dialect. I've been reading an interesting book on the rise and fall of the British Empire, and we were talking about this a little with Eric Metaxas.
The British Empire?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was on the Roman Empire, because that's a classic, obviously.
No!
It's the British Empire.
Yeah,
okay.
By Neil Ferguson.
It hasn't completely fallen. It's still there.
The rise and decline.
Okay.
It's a commonwealth, which is a little different, I think, than an empire.
They have Northern Ireland.
Today. And what I thought was so interesting, and Eric Metaxas and I were talking about this, was the prominence of guys like Wilberforce and the Clapham folks, you know, and how they changed the world with morality. And what's interesting for me, because I grew up in Iowa, small town Iowa, we never heard of any of that. You know, we weren't even familiar. I think I grew up with the impression that I think many middle American Christians have that America is the only really Christian nation, you know, in the world, and that world missions and evangelism, all of these things, you know, are practically American inventions. And then you go back in history and you realize all the way up through the 19th century, you know, if it wasn't the British leading the way, it was at least the British and the Americans in lockstep, you know, starting missionary societies, starting Bible societies, all of that stuff, you know, that was side by side. So here's my question for you, because you would know a lot more about this than I did. What happened to that tradition in England, you know, where we now look at England as, well, you're just like Europe, you know, you're just, I mean, what happened to the Methodists and that zeal, and, you know, when did it start to fade, and why did it fade faster there than in America?
You know, there are very serious analyses how in three generations that Wilberforce effect undercut itself. So you had powerful convictions, Wilberforce's generation. Their sons were people described as conventions. They believed the same things, but rather more nominally. And their children, literally, were in the world of addictions. You know, the Bloomsbury group, people like Virginia Woolf, was the grandson, a granddaughter of Wesley's friends, I mean of Wilberforce's friends. So it actually happened in a very short time. And I think one of the saddest reasons, they didn't think. And so people reacted to an evangelicalism which was anti-intellectual and non-thinking. And that was extremely sad.
And that didn't happen.
Now, if you look at the culture, here? You could say things like World War I, it didn't hit America like it hit Europe. World War I was a shattering event in terms of confidence and the whole sense of the moral stature of civilization.
Right. But I've often heard that said as the shattering of the notion of progress. You know, the notion that, man is getting better and better as we throw off religion, as we throw off superstition, and we become, you know, industrialized. And then World War I was, we just industrialized warfare. You know, maybe we were wrong. I mean, how did that undermine,
Because the churches were so much behind both sides.
Oh,
you know, the bishops blessing the bombers and all that sort of stuff. So there's the beginning of a massive crisis of revulsion against the churches and against faith. I mean, there are many, many factors.
Right. And why?
But the worst of it happened before the war. That's the sad thing.
Okay.
But what? How does that relate now to what we're seeing in the United States? Because I think a lot of people would argue that evangelicalism is not exactly thinking well now either.
Right.
Are we heading down the same road?
Oh,
I believe you wrote a book called Fit Bodies, Fat Minds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, ever since that book came out, along with Mark Knowles, there's been huge strides forward.
Sorry, that was a delayed bell.
Oh, yes.
But they haven't, you know, hasn't reached the average evangelical congregation. And as you know well, I think, you know, my son's generation, hundreds of thousands of them dropping out in revulsion against the religious right.
Right.
And that's the sad feature today. And no, it's American evangelicalism is shallow and extremely worldly and much to be disgusted by. And, you know, a few years ago I was involved in the Evangelical Manifesto, but it started with a fortnight in which I met 12 young evangelicals all giving up. And I asked them why, and each one of them described something, and I said, well, if that was evangelical, I wouldn't be either. You know, none of them had a view of evangelicalism earlier than Billy Graham.
Well, that begs the question then, and I know you talk about this in the Evangelical Manifesto, is the word itself has become so laden with baggage and misconceptions that when you use it, people assume all kinds of things that we don't mean. Mm-hmm. So is it even a useful term in the way we identify ourselves?
You pick and choose. I'm going to stick with it because as soon as you discuss what sort of tradition you follow, evangelical is the earliest and the deepest. So the three main ones, evangelical, orthodox, and Catholic. Well, the universality is very, very important, but it's not primary. And equally, orthodoxy, Jesus didn't come preaching orthodoxy.
Right.
He came preaching the evangel. And so I think actually it's earlier and deeper and more decisive than any of the others. I personally will never give it up.
It's a very good, rich, historical term, identity, for sure.
But theological, too.
And theological. And for those who may not be aware, evangelical comes from euangelion, the Greek word meaning gospel or good news. So it is very, very rich. But as far as its usefulness in our contemporary society.
When did it come into common usage and at what point?
Well, it went sort of culture-wide with the born-again movement.
Okay.
You know, which isn't actually as primary as the word evangelical in the scriptures, obviously.
Right.
Jesus only said that to one person secretly, and yet that's become predominant.
If they hadn't written it down.
No, the baggage is unquestioned. I mean, the cultural baggage, the political baggage is plain disgusting.
But having said that,
I would fight for the real thing.
It's baggage that we've brought upon ourselves. It hasn't been put on us by the outside labels. We did this over the last generation by becoming so politically engaged. Yep.
I was challenging some people at lunch today because one of them was a Southerner. I'm an evangelical. And I said to him, do you hear even the way you say the word invites a caricature? In England, I mean, this is ridiculous in a way, but in England we say evangelical.
Right.
Short E.
See, that sounds more intelligent already.
No, but you can't caricature it that way. But evangelical, you know, this must be very weird, this whoever believes this. And I just change the way you pronounce it.
Well, now you've got to
fight. That's the solution.
Yes.
No. A tiny point, but it's the beginning.
It's a good point.
In other words, personally, I've given up on Protestant.
Using the word.
Yeah. It doesn't – what are we protesting against? And it's purely negative.
Right.
And it's the 16th century. But evangelicalism will never, ever go out of date. It'll always fight its way out from under the baggage.
And if someone introduced you – Would you would want to be labeled as evangelical?
No, I mean, you wouldn't call David Brooks, say, a Jewish op-ed writer.
Okay.
He's an op-ed writer at the New York Times. Now,
evangelical has more implication about how you will write your op-ed.
I know, but they try and label us. So you can say an evangelical writer if you're only that. And, of course, the overtones, please dismiss this person.
Right.
I mean, the same with Francis Schaeffer. I was introduced by the president of Columbia University once, and he went out of his way, and I thought this is odd, to say, here is a disciple of Francis Schaeffer.
Oh.
And he was categorizing me before I spoke, and I gave my basically my talk on civility. He came up afterwards and he said, "I apologize for the introduction. Oh. I didn't realize you took a very different position from Francis Schaeffer." And you can see he was deliberately trying
to. I have a large paintbrush. I'm going to paint him yellow before he steps up here. Wow. Speaking of the case for civility, ring the bell. Okay. Which was your most recent book. You have a new one that's about to come out, but that was the prior one. I have been, you know, as a casual but growing observer of politics, I'm a filmmaker first and foremost, so that it isn't where I live, but watching more and more, I have become more and more concerned about exactly what you're talking about, which is not just the fact that people are yelling at each other, but that some of the loudest yelling is coming from people that are followers of Christ. Mm-hmm. You know, and the most, in some cases, the most strident, you know, resistance to compromise, resistance to working together, mm-hmm. is coming from followers of Jesus Christ. What's your basic contention in that book?
Well, it's an even-handed critique of the left and the right.
Okay.
But when we're talking about our own people, I would argue they're tarnishing the name of Christ in two ways. One is by being politicized, trusting politics to do more than politics can ever be expected to do.
Right.
The other problem, maybe even worse Christianly, is that they're, put it in the 18th century language, they're doing the Lord's work in the world's way. And if the means don't serve the ends, they will always subvert them. And you can see, I mean, our Lord, what's the toughest thing he called us to do? Maybe it's to love our enemies, certainly to forgive without limit. Many right. of the call of our Lord, they're radical. But the religious right demonizes, stereotypes, uses fear-mongering, and so on. These are sub-Christian things, very different from great politicians like Wilberforce.
And did we borrow them from the other side? Did we make them up?
Well, you know, the mood in America is whatever it takes. The right. issues are so desperate, whatever it takes.
Right.
And so Christians just fallen into it.
Yeah.
The issue was that, I mean, the early days, 75, you remember, the sleeping giant had woken up, and it was just a matter of time we could
right.
exercise our muscles, take it over. And then it didn't happen. And as it didn't happen, that note of desperation and whatever it takes, and this is so urgent, we got to resort to these tactics, came in.
Well, what about the, now there's a backlash, that all the statistics are showing that the religious right has done damage to the younger generation's perception of Christianity. We have this exodus of young people from the church, the acknowledgement that they pursued cultural engagement in a way which is not consistent with the way of Christ. But now I see in my generation something of an overreaction that they don't want anything to do with politics or the public square, and let's just privatize the faith again. So how do you respond to those folks?
That's the other extreme. I mean, I would say that for two-thirds of the 20th century, evangelicals were pietistic in theology, privatized in terms of politics. And that was disastrous. So I first came in 68, including to Wheaton, and came from Harvard to Wheaton. And I would have to say the only person in 68 that I met, evangelical, who understood the 60s, and 68 was the high point,
right.
was Carl Henry. Most evangelicals were shocked it was going on. They had no understanding of it at all. And that was disastrous because the wake-up year was 73.
With Watergate, Roe v. Wade.
Roe v. Wade.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't actually. Roe v. Wade, it took a year or so before evangelicals
twigged.
We didn't
notice.
They didn't notice it.
Yeah.
The OPEC crisis and Watergate were the immediate things, and then Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. And the moral majority is 75. But we've swung since then to the other extreme, politicized. And now, with the disillusionment at that, as you say, that the danger is to go back. And I say we've got to be politically engaged, but not politically equated. We're Christ people. We're not Republicans or Democrats first.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a distinction? Because looking back at someone like Wilberforce, because I've had such a strong negative reaction to just some of the really strident, yelling and hollering from pulpits, on conservative radio. And looking back at someone like Wilberforce to say, okay, but he was. Well, he was in there every day. He was engaging with politics. He was trying to do good things through the political system. How do we do that without making enemies? You know, how do you work through the political system while loving your neighbors when you may be campaigning against them?
Well, for example, he had enemies. And he was the most vilified man probably in the world. He had people in the royal family as well as financial interests, as well as the heroes of England, such as Lord Nelson. They were all against him.
Okay.
All against him. And he was twice physically attacked, mugged by his opponents.
Wow.
But he always went out of his way to love them and responded in that way. Once when one of his worst enemies died, Wilberforce saw out of his own money that the man's widow had a pension.
Okay.
And whether it was practical or the civil way he treated people, eventually he won them over. You know,
right.
As Lincoln says, the only way to deal with your enemy is to turn them into a friend by loving them.
Okay.
And Wilberforce genuinely did that.
And do you see that today?
No.
No. We've lost that feeling.
We really
have. We've lost that loving feeling.
Yeah. Now, you've got people like, say, but he's not part of the Christian right,
yeah.
People like Rick Warren.
Yeah.
You know, who's terrific. I was there when one of the leading ACT UP leaders came to Christ. And I asked him, you know, what had brought him there. He said, well, I met this pastor at a Clinton philanthropy meeting. He didn't know his pastor first, this big teddy bear of a man who just put his arm around my shoulder and said, tell me a story.
Huh.
And he said, an hour later, I found myself in tears. No one had ever asked me my story. And then I realized he was a pastor.
Wow.
And just Rick reaching out to him in that way, and Rick does that so well with everyone, and we should all be like that.
Yeah. Well, there's definitely something good in there. In that same book, A Case for Civility, you refute, you say, both the sacred public square and the naked public square. Can you explain those two terms for a younger generation?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at 50 years of culture warring, and now the same thing happening in Europe and around much of the world, you can see there's a dueling two visions. The sacred public square is where you have one religion preferred or established and everyone else second class. You have mild versions. The Church of England's about as mild as you can get. A strong version would be Saudi Arabia.
Right.
You know, you could be beheaded for doing the wrong thing.
Right.
The naked public
square. For tweeting an insult of the prophet.
Of the prophet, exactly. You know, the naked public square is where all religions excluded, which means, of course, that secularism comes in through the back door. And again, you've got mild versions. France is relatively mild. China is obviously a very severe version.
Mm-hmm.
And the civil public square comes between those, a vision of public life in which everybody is free to enter and engage public life on the basis of their faith, that's freedom of conscience, but with respect for everybody's else's right to do the same. Now, that assumes things like if we go in the public square, we have to persuade people, we can't coerce them, and so on.
But isn't that what a lot of Christians in the American context are fearful of? Because they don't want to share the public square with, we've talked about this in the podcast before, the rise of Muslim communities in the United States and others, and they're seen as other and different and scary, and that's not American, and we need to really assert ourselves so that Christianity has a dominant role. And the idea of sharing the public school debate, the prayer in public school debate is about
people
this.
Who argue that will lose, we have no dominance now, it's gone. And they will hasten its end. But what they're doing is mirroring the Protestant nativist arguments in the 19th century against the Catholics.
Right.
They were the feared ones then. And, of course, Catholics who were embraced and took on the American experiment became some of the best defenders of religious freedom and these things. And if we were to embrace the Muslims in the sense, you're in our tent now, this is how we live. We all have a right to enter and engage. You do, too. But we're not talking about a caliphate here. This is within the Constitution.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Teach them what our way is because they're in our tent and so on.
But a lot of them want to say that our tent is a Christian tent. It's not an American tolerant tent.
What does the phrase Christian nation mean to you?
Well,
I don't even know how to define
it. It's confusing and a code word in the culture wars because if you take the three elements, were most of the ideas Christian? Of course. Were most of the people in the 18th century Christians? Of course. But was, here's the key third point, was America formally, officially Christian? Absolutely not.
Okay. I have every now and then, you know, my wife will show me an email or something someone has sent her that's, you know, just very angry about, you know, and the Pilgrims founded America to be a Christian nation. And I always just say, I think the Pilgrims founded Massachusetts. I don't think they founded America. No, I absolutely think that came later. And we seem to just miss that.
We're closer, say, to Roger Williams and the, you know, Rhode Island experiment than we are to Massachusetts.
The Baptists.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
and Christians should never be afraid. Are we afraid of getting into the public square in a free debate? No. The trouble is a lot of Christians don't know how to persuade.
Right.
And the pro-life movement shows that. Sadly, the defense of marriage shows that.
They don't want to be challenged.
Well, growing up in a small town in Iowa, and, you know, I had lots of conservative Christian friends, and I travel in lots of conservative Christian circles. When I was a kid, there was very little conversation about politics. It just wasn't coming up. You know, it was early 70s. We were scared of hippies. I remember my grandparents, you know, every time we'd see someone with long hair, it was, I don't know about... But there wasn't a whole lot of talk about politics. And then suddenly I started, you know, so I'm in junior high. First hear the name Jerry Falwell, then hear the name James Dobson, you know. And suddenly everyone in my small church is talking about politics, you know, and Reagan. And then, you know, if we can, mm-hmm. and we have to, you know, and look what the, and it seemed to be so much of it was focused just on Roe v. Wade and the fact that there was a court somewhere that could change America without us getting to vote. Mm-hmm. You know, and it seemed to me that's what woke up, you know, everyone in kind of the culture that I come from to say, well, we're going to get active, you know. But there was a certain a lack of grace to our activity because we weren't used to doing it mm-hmm. that has led, you know, to just... Mm-hmm. It's, well, those are the bad guys. Those are the guys that put the guys in the court that can do unchristian things without us being able to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. So we have to get even more organized, you know, and then suddenly we're throwing around the word war, you know, in the context of the people living next to us. Mm-hmm. How do we get to a point where Christians, you know, who maybe don't have a history of political activity, because even, I mean, the Tea Party movement, you know, in a sense, you love the populism of it and the grassrootsiness of it and that it's, you know, it's people getting engaged. But there have been so many people that have been sent out of that movement with specific instructions. You are to go to Washington and you will not compromise. You know, how do we, and I think we equate that with, well, we're standing up for what's right. So when it's an issue of right and wrong, compromise is sin. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we get to the point? And I'm trying to just talk people down from that ledge to say, well, compromise is kind of foundational to collective
to politics.
Government, mm-hmm. unless you want to.
But not a compromise of principle. I mean, you look at Wilberforce, they knew how to engage politics Christianly. I mean, Wilberforce... The idea of co-belligerence. He worked with rogues and rascals. Whoever was against what he was against, he'd work with. You know, he wasn't a purist in that way, but there was absolutely no compromise of principle.
And how do you avoid making enemies, not just of you as a person, but of your faith?
Well, you have to be very secure. I mean, what you're describing is the fact that Christians woke up. Suddenly, the world they'd known the rug had been pulled out from under their feet.
Right.
And much of the Christian right is motivated by fear and desperate insecurity.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we've got to have people who are absolutely fearlessly confident in the Lord. Even if there's two Christians left in America, those two should move out fearlessly.
But
you know,
isn't that the big challenge, though? Because everything I hear in the media around Christian media and cultural engagement is fear-driven.
Absolutely.
So how do you motivate people with fear and then tell them, once you're in the public square, don't be afraid?
Well, the most common refrain, as you know, Sky, from the beginning of the end of the Scriptures, and especially in our Lord, have no fear.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, this is the beginning of the betrayal of the gospel when we fearmonger and we ourselves operate from fear. It's terrible.
So I totally agree, obviously. How then would you motivate the church to be politically engaged around these issues that are perhaps threatening and changing our culture, whether it be abortion or you pick it? Without appealing to fear, what does that look like? Can you give an example, perhaps, of what you've seen?
Has this ever been done well since Wilberforce?
Let's go back, though. My conviction is we're living in a time similar to St. Augustine. There he was after 800 years of Roman dominance. It was going, and he witnessed it. We are seeing the end of 500 years of Western dominance. And what Augustine did was peel Christians away from the easy identification with Rome and the kingdom. And that was a huge break. And he gave that vision in the City of God that laid down a bridge that went through the Dark Ages. Clearly today, we've got to challenge Christians to break. We are members of the kingdom first, not America. And we've got to make that break, be faithful to the kingdom, conduct ourselves in the way that people of the kingdom do, and so on, and explore politics out of that. Mm-hmm. And we're in an extraordinary moment.
How do we, 20 years ago, I would go to my father's church in rural Michigan, and on 4th of July, they would sing in church, "I'm proud to be an American," you know, together. They would sing patriotic songs from the pulpit, special music, the trio, you know. And now today, though, if you did that in most major churches, people would just roll their eyes and
I mean, Phil, what was it, 2 years ago? I won't name all the details, but someone published the Patriots Bible, which is taking the scripture and basically transposing Israel for America and filling it with all kinds of
American
propaganda.
I think they had a specific
propaganda.
Demographic in
mind.
Well,
yeah, my point is there is a demographic
that.
Who still buys that
It wasn't
stuff.
Young adults.
But in this polarized situation, the Patriots will get more and more diehard on one side, and then people who in the 60s would have been considered traitors to America will get more and more strong on the other side. We've got to break with all this. We are Christ people first, but patriotism's a wonderful thing. Nationalism is extremely dangerous, but patriotism's a wonderful thing properly. Well, patriotism's always under God. Nationalism becomes religious. It becomes God. Patriotism, we thank God for the, you know, where you came from in Iowa. And so on. I'm proud of Ireland.
Patriotism is specifically in American terms.
It's connected to a place. And there's a huge, I'm not American. I love and admire the best of this country. There's extraordinary things.
So can a Chinese citizen be a patriot?
Oh, of course.
Of China?
I love China. But he would love a China that the present government doesn't represent.
Okay.
In other words, the real China would be ashamed of what those barbarians are doing to their people today.
Okay.
So you love the best of your country over against the worst of it. Now, my current book is much more about this.
Yes, let's get into that. The new book is called A Free People's Suicide, Sustainable Freedom and the American Future. And it's coming out in August,
it's
right?
It's available for pre-order now.
It's available for pre-order now.
And I have an advanced copy.
I know, I'm so jealous of you. You're on the list that I'm not on. Yeah. Oh, well. And the premise of this book?
The argument is the most daring thing, and I say this as a great admirer of this country, there's nothing more daring in the American experiment than the idea they could create a free society that could stay free. And they figured out how they thought they could do that. Now, current Americans take that for granted, partly.
Right.
But they've also abandoned the framers' system. So modern American freedom, largely negative and libertarian, is literally unsustainable. And so I argue...
Why so?
Well,
I'm going to play the dummy. What are you talking about?
Let's start. Freedom in history has never, ever lasted. And there are various reasons why. You know, it runs into license and things like this. And so the question is, how do you sustain freedom? Well, the framers ransacked the classics to learn what the problems were, and then put in their antidote. Now, they didn't give a name to their antidote. Now, Tocqueville calls it the habits of the heart.
Okay.
I call it the golden triangle of freedom, the idea that freedom requires virtue.
Mm-hmm.
Virtue requires faith of some sort, and faith of any sort requires freedom. And like the recycling triangle, it goes round and round and round.
Right.
And all the framers believed that, whether evangelicals like John Jay and Patrick Henry or free thinkers like Ben Franklin. They all believed that, and yet modern Americans have abandoned that.
Right.
Today, all you rely on is law and constitution. And that's why in more and more situations, you're getting more laws, more regulations, and less freedom.
Hmm.
And you can see that I would argue that the culture wars are at root a freedom war.
Okay.
You know, Lincoln called the Civil War a freedom war, but I think this is the second freedom war, and you've got Jewish and Christian views on one side, often not very well articulated, and then secular, atheistic, rather humanist views on the other side, which are simply not sustainable.
Because they're not linked to a virtue and a faith.
Yeah.
So you mentioned briefly a negative view of freedom. Can you explain, and I've gotten this from the book, but the difference between negative freedom and positive freedom, because I think that's instructive in helping people. Because we often think, well, freedom means just let me do my thing.
Yeah.
Don't infringe on my freedom of choice.
Do whatever you like.
It's a very consumeristic view of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So explain the difference between that and positive freedom.
The distinction comes from Isaiah Berlin, the Jewish philosopher who died at Oxford not very long ago. Negative freedom is freedom from. Your freedom from your parents or from the police or from any constriction on your liberty. Positive freedom is freedom for, freedom to be. Now, you take Christian freedom when our Lord says you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. Freedom's within a framework of knowing who we are under Christ and so on. So the Christian view, you need both. It's not one or the other. It's both and. But most American freedom today, unlike the framers, is only freedom from. You know, get the government off my back. The government can't interfere with my body, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
It's libertarian.
But you see it on both sides.
Right.
Oh, yeah. You
it's
see
just
that,
different,
you know,
applied differently.
Get your laws off my body, and you say, get your laws off my money.
Exactly. You know, one's the liberal, one's conservative. You're
right.
But neither side is really articulating a freedom for.
Neither.
How did we get there?
Well, you can trace the effects in a lot of ways. I mean, I would argue against our fellow Christians. The basic rot happened in the church in the 19th century with the privatization of religion, the growth of pietism. In other words, religion became less than Christian discipleship, so it's unable to do the job.
Hmm.
You know, in the 20th century, you have very obvious movements like, say, proceduralism. John Rawls from Harvard, the idea that the public square is neutral.
Mm-hmm.
Religion's inviolably private, so you can't bring in faith, character, and virtue. They're private. The
right.
public square is that neutral arena of competing interests.
Right.
Faith can't come in. And that idea is pretty well dominant in the educated classes today.
It even seems like it's dominated in the pastoral class, because when I talk to pastors about social issues or public square issues, they say to me pretty across the board, wherever the issue is we're talking about, well, I don't want to bring that up in the pulpit because that could be divisive and that's for people to figure out on their own. We're just here to talk about the gospel, as if the gospel has no place in the public square when we deal with issues of education or immigration or taxes or you name it.
Right, right.
Because we've privatized faith.
Yeah, but you've got two extremes. That's one extreme. And then you've got the sort of pastor who wants to politicize the pulpit.
Right,
right.
And if you go back to, say, Tocqueville when he comes and when he writes Democracy in America, he says the preachers preached the principle, but they didn't get into politics. But the point is they didn't need to, because they taught the scriptures so well that the lay people went out and lived it.
Hmm.
Today, the fact that some pastors want to politicize it is an expression of how poor the preaching's been.
Okay, so that brings up a quote that I saw. I don't know if it's from you or it's from something you wrote that I took very personally, which is
that you're a good friend. That, I'm sure it wasn't personal.
That we are a nation of Indians ruled by Swedes.
Ah, that's Peter Berger.
Because I am Indian and Swedish. So can you, it's Peter Berger. Can you explain that and how that relates to this?
Well, Berger, you know, says the American people are the most religious of all modern people, on a par only with India, the most religious country in the world. Whereas the American elites, the educated elites, are as secular as Sweden. So he says, we're a nation of Indians ruled by Swedes.
Which is backwards for me because my father's more secular and my mother's more religious.
So it's
the India of Sweden.
But not
generally.
Yeah. That's weird.
No,
but okay, here's
put it in a blender.
But the very serious point behind this is that the secularization theory that the world's going secular is wrong.
Right.
You know, they used to think Europe was the avant-garde and America was an odd exception. Now we know America's like the rest of the world. Europe's the odd man out.
Right.
And there are two exceptions. One is the geographical one, Europe. The other is the social one, the educated classes.
Hmm.
Now, that means, of course, concern for the kingdom, we've got to win back Europe.
So,
and that's beginning to happen.
But
and we've also got to bring back the educated classes.
It speaks to the fact that the world is becoming more and more religious, not more and more secular, and that a lot of the conflicts we see around the world are the result of religious groups, communities, in friction with each other. You see it in Nigeria, you see it in Sudan, you see it in the Middle East, obviously, you see it in Egypt, the revolution there and the conflict now between some of the Coptic Christians and the Muslims. So those of us who have a faith background in the West— need to bring that into the public square just to understand our world today, whereas the secular elites don't get it because they don't think about the world in religious terms.
Absolutely. I'm slightly changing your question here, but Christians are fabulous at fighting evils, whether it's Wilberforce, slavery, or sex trafficking today. What we've got to do as well as that is try and make constructive solutions to human problems. Now, you mentioned one of the world's biggest problems today, how do we live with our deep differences mm-hmm. in a world in which it's said everyone is everywhere? You know, it's not just little private religious preferences
right.
that make diversity. You've got entire worldviews, entire ways of life, elbow to elbow with other entire worldviews
right.
and ways of life
so,
in the same society.
What's
that's
your
right.
answer? Did
well,
you figure it out?
Yeah. No, this is why some of us are fighting for this idea of a civil public square
right.
globally. I mean,
do
next,
you see
next
that,
week
do you
in
see
Europe,
that
Phil,
really happening anywhere
no, because,
where you can point
because
to?
It's an idea. At the moment, as I said, you've got this dueling vision.
Right.
No one has ever articulated the
But it
idea.
Needs to be modeled, and shouldn't it ideally be modeled by Christian leaders?
Let's just pick one small
be.
Town, say Wheaton, Illinois, will run for office, and we'll model it.
Well, but you got to do it in a, you know, somewhere where the world will take notice of it.
Oh, are you saying we're not the
what?
Center of the world?
What? Oh,
no,
man.
No, next week, a European group spearheaded by evangelicals are publishing a global charter of conscience.
Oh.
In Brussels. And it's an attempt to put this on the table
okay.
in the European Union. Because let's be blunt, America is the most wealthy country in the world, still the most powerful. But much of the rest of the world is not listening to America now.
Yeah, I've noticed.
Sadly.
I'm still talking.
Sadly. So
yeah.
they've chosen to do it in Europe, but launching this idea of civil public square,
uh-huh. in,
whether it's picked up, may fall like a leaf in the forest.
Well, and Europe needs it as well because of the conflicts
oh,
emerging
absolutely.
With the immigrant communities there.
Right, right. Well, here's another question. I had read, I don't know if you read Charles Murray's new book, Coming Apart.
Read reviews, I'm afraid, I'm
okay.
at this stage.
And one of his concerns, you know, it's about, Bell?
It didn't ring.
Oh, so, okay, there we go. Coming Apart by Charles Murray. And it's his concern is that America has become a country of classes, and they've become stratified, you know, fairly rigid. And specifically, this upper, you know, 1-3% that is, you know, has the most education, that they're and that has the positions of influence in most of the major industries, that it's become, they've really become separate, and they never bump into anyone else in
right.
America, that it's two different Americas. But he also said, which I thought was an interesting point, he's trying to get people excited about what America used to be, but he says many from that upper 1-2% no longer really think of themselves as Americans, but as citizens of the world,
mm-hmm.
you know, and their businesses are global. I mean, I've got a friend who's mm-hmm. he's in Chicago this week, he's in Berlin next week, he's in Paris the week after that, because it's global business. And I see in the younger generation, there's almost a little embarrassment, partly in Christians, because our parents and grandparents went so far, you know, into nationalism with the religious right, that we're almost embarrassed to think of ourselves as Americans, you know, when we're thinking, no, but we're citizens of the world.
Mm-hmm.
How can you fix a country if you're no longer excited about it?
Yeah, the way I'd respond to that, Phil, is to try and put the principles at stake on the table. And then get people to think biblically. So you're raising two fundamental questions, among others. One is the clash between liberty and equality. They're
right.
not opponents, but they're uneasy partners. And if you give too much liberty, it will always create huge inequalities. And that's what's happened in economics and various things in this country
mm-hmm.
in the last 25 years. You've got savage inequities, which are profoundly unjust.
Right.
Liberty has run riot. And we need to have equality. But the Democrats and some of the liberals and the secularists are bringing in equality, non-discrimination,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
in ways that are equally dangerous. So that's one issue. We've got to think that through. The other issue is the big issue, the global and the local. So you're right. Some people are going heavily global,
right.
and others are going heavily local, sort of the Wendell Berrys and so on. And I think the scriptures, you have both. Obviously, the scriptures talk about the whole earth being blessed
right,
in the family.
Right.
And yet it's person to person, the essence of the incarnation, is God becoming one person, and so on. So we've got to keep alive both.
But it's very hard to get cosmopolitan people to mingle with provincial people and vice versa. And we feel more and more like it's red state, blue state, or it's the 1% versus the 99. And
so should my bumper sticker say, God bless America, God bless Wheaton, or God bless the world?
All three.
Wow. That's a big bumper sticker.
No. You have three cars.
Yes.
No, but take Dubose's famous maxim, think globally, act locally.
Yes.
I think we can do that, and the notion that does it for us Christians is calling. Because calling is a focus. We've got to pray for the world.
Right.
We've got to give to a certain extent to the world. We've got to do certain things for the world. But the focus of what our callings is always somewhere. There's a bullseye. You guys, your home is Wheaton. My home is Washington, D.C. I'm happy to be here.
I've heard of
Hopefully,
that.
Hopefully, you know, you're happy to come to us occasionally. But, you know, we all have a bullseye. That's the local, and it's very, very important to think incarnationally.
Mm-hmm.
And the trouble is today with, you know, all the churches that have all these links and so on, we're getting less and less of the incarnational.
Right. Another interesting thing that Charles Murray brought up in Coming Apart was he gave a list in the, I believe, mid-19th century, six churches in Manhattan and all the social programs that they had launched. Just this random group of six churches. And it was a list of close to 100 things, you know, from soup kitchens to children's activities. And they're all things, by and large, that today either the state is providing, you know, but churches aren't. You know, churches have turned more inward for the most part and are providing services for their members. You know, like some of our mega churches are more like country clubs, in my opinion, you know, than churches that were more inwardly focused. How do you go back? You know,
the Industrial Revolution created the greatest human problems ever seen to that time. And the best responders were churches. And what they did was heroic. And what you're describing with the charity organization societies in New York grew out of Thomas Chalmers in Glasgow. And he split Glasgow up. Every single block was covered. And he was by a church.
Wow.
And it was magnificent. But here's the point. The cities grew even faster. The problems were even deeper. Who could cover it? No one could through voluntary things. In came the state.
Right.
And then, of course, we've gone to the other extreme now, which climaxed in the 60s, where it was all the state. Now we're rolling that back, but a lot of people are caught in the gap.
Right.
So I think we've got to be realistic. If you look at the history of philanthropy, there's never been a final solution that was effective. Any generation solution always was outgrown by a subsequent generation. We've got to be very humble. There will never, ever be a final good solution in a fallen world.
Okay. So how often should we say America should solve this problem versus the church should solve this problem?
I wouldn't say either quite like that. We've got to say all of us within the context of our callings do all we can. And since we are the church, we'll do a lot more than we're doing now. America clearly can't. The limits of American power. I mean, I grew up in the 50s in England.
Okay.
Churchill was still saying, I'm not elected to preside over the decline of the British Empire, but he did, and he was. And you're going through, sadly, I'm afraid, a similar period. You're going to be pulling back all your forces from around the world. You simply can't afford it. The American power is ending.
Well, that's kind of depressing. No. On that note, give us some hope.
You always
give us some hope.
Well, the hope is surely always in the kingdom. And, you know, I mentioned Augustine, but think of Daniel. I mean, Daniel had the privilege and the incredible responsibility. All the prophets and all Israel up to them had talked of Israel and the covenant. And now Israel was shattered. Jerusalem was gone. And what's the Lord's vision to him? It's of world empires, but still the kingdom that was indestructible and everlasting.
Right.
And we've got a shift in this global era to that. We're not thinking of England or America now. You know, it really is the course of empires and the kingdom that will never end. And we're members of that, and our calling should be seen under that. And it will never be destroyed. I'm a person of incredible hope. But if we had more time, you can see how there is hope even for America. if America was to recover some of its first things, I would argue that America, like the Reformation, like the Renaissance, there are certain things in the world that go forward best by going back first. Hmm. And the idea we have to be relevant, up to date, chasing the latest, greatest is absolute folly. Hmm. America needs to rediscover what made it once great and go back to those roots, and it could happen. Hmm. All is not lost.
So if I'm a 20-year-old Christian college student and I'm sick of the religious right and I think politics is just a mess and I shouldn't be involved in it and I don't have much hope about America or the church, what do you say? Well, what's your advice?
Well, Phil, one of the stories I love is of Thomas Lineker, who is Henry VIII's surgeon, friend of Sir Thomas More and Erasmus. He could read Latin and Greek. You know, in those days, they didn't have the Bible. It was only for the clergy. But a friend gave him the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And he could read Greek. He read them fast for the first time in his life, and he handed them back with this famous comment, "Either these are not the Gospels, or we're not Christians." Just a year or two later, Martin Luther hammered 95 theses to a church door to attack that. Now, we're there today. What's going on in America is sometimes a million miles from Jesus and the way of Jesus. And we've got to have people who say, I'm sick of what's happening here, the shallowness, the worldliness, whatever. Mm-hmm. Go back to him. There's where the hope is. And we'll, by God's grace, see a new reformation, new revival in our time.
Hmm. Awesome.
Wow.
I think we're out of time.
Hard to beat that.
No, I don't think we can, so I'm not going to try, but I'll try to summarize it with a closing song. Let's see here. We had a podcast. The time went too fast. And now we're done with Oz Guinness, who isn't the one that drinks the beer but didn't make the beer, but his great-great-great-great-grandfather did. And hope he comes back to Wheaton sometime soon so we can have him on again and figure out how to solve all the world's problems of social and economical and inequality issues. Hopefully. Thank you, Oz.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for coming to the podcast. That's it for this week, everybody. We'll talk to you later. Bye.